That is the unmistakable sound of Patti Smith with Gloria in Excelsis Deo, the opening track from Horses, the album she released 50 years ago this November. She'll be performing it live at Dublin's Three Arena on the 6th of October as part of her European tour. Patti Smith was already making a name for herself as a poet and a visual artist in New York in 1975. Horses was her debut album produced by the great John Cale, and while it may have initially been something of a slow burner, with it she staked her claim as a musical force to be reckoned with. Lise Hand is with me now in studio to talk about it. Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. As opening lines go, that's not a bad manifesto for an album, is it?
Do you know, it literally hits you straight between the eyes. It's unconventional, it's confrontational, it's uncompromising, but it's just a wonderful piece of word, smithery as well, sets out the stall, I think, of where this album is going. It's like, this isn't going to be Moonspoon June. This is going to be something very different. I'm going to be talking about the big themes. I'm going to be talking about love, sex, death. I'm going to be throwing in all kinds of poetry. Like, everything is almost in that initial sentence. And the command at which she just throws it out there, it forces you to sit up and listen. And I think that is one of the keys for this whole album. Couldn't ignore it.
Yeah, explain maybe for those people who don't necessarily know where she came from, how this album came into being. Where's the run up to this?
Well, Patti Smith and her band, they had become a bit of a fixture in a very famous New York dive club called CBGB's. And it really sort of was the wellspring from where came bands like the Velvet Underground and Television, Blondie. So they had that. The Ramones, of course, famously as well. So it had that sort of punk ethos, but like New York punk, really, which did incorporate a lot more. It kind of did incorporate poetry and it incorporated social commentary. These people were sort of art. They weren't afraid of art with a capital A. They didn't run from it. And they all hung around together and they were bouncing ideas off each other. And there was this amazing energy. So out of that, Clive Davis and Marista, who, very storied kind of spotter of talent, spotted her, signed her, and realised he had something on his hands, but wasn't really quite sure what to do with her. I mean, because she was this wild child, this whirling dervish with long dark hair, skinny, went on stage and lost it and was just doing transcendent poetry and word games, and there was this sort of punk thing going on, and he was like, what the hell am I going to do with you? So do you know what he did? Very, very smart thing. He let her at it. He let her just rip. He just said, right, we'll put this album out and we'll just see what we've got.
Okay, we're going to dig into the album, but it is one of those that you can very much judge by its cover.
Yes.
Because the photo on the front of the album of Patti by the legendary Robert Mapplethorpe, it's an iconic photo in the history of rock.
It's completely iconic. It was so unlike anything else that was out there. A lot of overwrought kind of colour, covers, and sort of coming out of the late 60s where there was an awful lot of psychedelia and so on, so the covers are really in your grill. This is sort of monochromatic, incredibly stark. She's just sort of leaning against a wall in a white shirt that she'd bought in the Salvation Army. And she, because she liked the monogram, because it reminded her of a Brassai photograph, like, this is where we're going here. Her own black jacket, some black ribbons she liked. And Robert Mapplethorpe and herself were lifelong friends. Well, she met him literally the day she arrived to New York. 20 years old, had just given a baby up for adoption, went to crash in somebody's house and found that they had moved on and he was there. They became lifelong friends, lovers for a while. And he literally just said, stand against that wall there and I'll knock off a few shots. And she recounts this. She said, I'll take 12. And he got to 8 and he says, I have it. And she goes, how do you know? And he just said, I just know. And which, is just such a, it's just such a great,
it sounds like how geniuses operate. They just go, look, I have it.
That's exactly it. It's just how geniuses operate. Like, but also the sort of, that punk spirit, we're going back to that sort of punk spirit. That's the slight ramshackleness of it, and it was very different from, say, the punk spirit that was just coming through in the UK at the time, in London. I mean, she was 1975. So at this stage, you know, the charts literally had things like Rhinestone Cowboy, Glen Campbell, Mandy, Barry Manilow, Fame, actually David Bowie. But, you know, the charts were not challenging songs. Let's just put it that way. All fine things. And yet around, circling around, was all this madness. Like, you had the fall of Saigon, the end of the Vietnam War. You had the Khmer Rouge just starting their genocide. You had Watergate, literally, that was the year where Watergate just blew completely open and we ended up with the resignation of Richard Nixon, which was a traumatic event in America. But the sort of punk spirit in the UK was very different. And it all came slightly after her. You had that sort of 3 minute, sort of the very simple chord progression, a 3 minute song and a kind of nihilistic, let's burn it all down. Whereas what Patti has said she wants to do was reach out to sort of the misfits and the disconnected and wake up the, you know, try and get dispel the torpor that American music seemed to have been in. They just weren't reflecting the times.
Because it is one of those things that you allegedly have bands like the Sex Pistols and the Clash in the UK. They're British punk. And obviously she sort of fits into the American punk thing, but doesn't necessarily, even though both of them are put in this little box that's called punk, they're radically different styles of music, mostly in terms of where they come from.
Totally radically different. I mean, you had the incredible energy of the London punk scene, which was very anti-establishment. It was very much about sort of tearing down the sacred cows of sort of English life and trying to express rage for, you know, against inequality. But it was quite nihilistic to a certain extent as well. It was painting quite bleak pictures. Whereas what Patti Smith and her band and some of the bands that were swirling around at that time in New York, they were literally just sort of into surrealism, and they were kind of tackling the big topics. But, you know, again, but the music quite that underpinned this quite often, and particularly in Horses, it was quite punky it was fast and hard music to a lot of the time. And then she sort of soared and growled and swooped over it. So I think that's why Horses didn't spin off into something that was completely unlistenable, was the fact that it was underpinned by a great band. I mean, Tom Verlaine played on one of the tracks, and you had this, you know, so you did have that sort of good old raunchy proper rock and roll rock sort of sound and rhythm kind of driving through some of the tracks. But then you've unexpected things, like you've a little bit of jazz, and one of the kind of bleaker tracks in one way has this sort of cheery upbeat kind of reggae sound to it.
Yeah, there's an element of that in Redondo Beach. Birdland, yeah, sounds almost like nothing else on the album as well. Yeah. There are lots of really different sounds all in one place.
Exactly. And I think that's what makes, I think when I sort of, when I said it commands your attention, it sort of does, in a way that it made music become an active thing. You had to actively listen to it. You couldn't just sort of sit back and, you know, open a can of beer and let it wash over you while you're on your phone and watching something on telly. Well, of course, you wouldn't have phones back then. But, you know, it required your attention and it sort of drew you in, because they were stories, you know, that she sort of told. It wasn't just disconnected lyrics. I mean, there were stories behind them, and they drew you in, but you were forced to listen because you just weren't too sure what was going on, what was happening next. I mean, there really had been nothing else like it.
In terms of her obsession with the poet Arthur Rimbaud, Horses released on the date that he died. Her obsession continues to this day. She was posting about him on Instagram a couple of days ago. Where's the connection with that? Why is that part of the Horses story?
Well, she just, at a very early age, she just started reading, you know, she just fell in love with the poetry of Arthur Rimbaud and Baudelaire and a lot of those writers. And she has stayed faithful, you know, to that. I mean, it informed the lyrics and a lot of the sensibility behind the way that she kind of riffed on lyrics in Horses. And, you know, she was still, I saw her in Vicar Street last year, and she's still quoting, you know, this is the well that she goes to draw from when she needs some kind of inspiration and so on. And I think she just loved the deconstructive nature of things. You know, she took song structures and just broke them down, and the way that lyrics are supposed to be written, and broke them down. And I think that, you know, that sort of symbolism and sort of free-flowing poetry is really just what, you know, just, I think it's just inspired her.
What about the production on this? Because he's still a great artist in his own right. He was one of the Velvet Underground. Tell me about John Cale's role in this as a producer.
Well, it's funny because when I was sort of reading a little bit about the production of the album, and it's when you listen to the two of them talking about how they got on. It sometimes actually sounds like a therapist and a patient kind of talking to each other, because it was a difficult birth, this album, because, he was, again, I think he understood that he had something, a free spirit, and he didn't, again, try and say, you have to do this sound and you have to do that sound. But he was dealing, again, with that slight punk ramshackle sensibility. I mean, when they arrived into Electric Lady Studio to start recording, their instruments were in bits. They were just banjaxed. So
he had to buy them new ones, didn't he?
He had to go out and buy them new ones, which is definitely going sort of above and beyond the normal thing. Yeah. But, he sort of talked about, the clashes that sort of happened between them. And he sort of said it was like an immutable force meeting an immovable object. So they did clash. And I think she was quite ungracious to some extent afterwards and, didn't really give him the credit he deserved. And I think it was only really as the time went on, and maybe she just became more experienced about the whole process of recording, that she really kind of gave him credit for, helping them put some kind of shape on the sounds, because they were wonderful live performers at that stage, but they probably didn't have a huge amount of recording time. So I think there was that clash of an experienced musician, but one that was also experienced enough to let her know that he could not try and constrain what she was doing.
You mentioned seeing her in recent years as a live performer. She's even got a couple of members of the original group are still playing with her. What's she like?
Live? Well, I was, to be honest, I had sort of had a run of going to see musicians who had been, around a long time and going, and quite often maybe their voices had just weren't up to, understandably, in passage of time, and their voices hadn't the vitality that they'd had maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But like, she was just, I couldn't believe how good she was. She just bounced on stage, looked exactly the same, except the hair was greyer, and just had that, again, had that commanding presence. Voice was fantastic, but she had the entirety of the audience. Now, okay, granted, sold out, adoring crowd, but she literally had them eating out of the palm of her hand, And the set had great humour as well and vitality. I mean, she threw in a Lana Del Rey cover. We got a bit of Nirvana. And then, of course, because she is such a passionate activist as well, she talked about Palestine and We Have the Power. And it was a really, I think for people, I was actually really pleased to see there was quite a lot of like young heads. It wasn't just all grey and bald, in the place, which quite often happens at these times. And I loved to see that there were young, and you could see them just going, what is this? Like, what is this? Because it's not safe music, You might have all the liner notes in the world, but it's not safe. You don't know what's coming next. You don't know what she's going to do or what she's going to say, which is really probably the purest of punk spirit. It's not so much, the three chords and, F the Establishment. Like, what the proper punk is, you just have no idea where it's going to take you, and you just got to take a bit of blind faith and follow it.
Like with a lot of albums of the type that become incredibly influential, it wasn't necessarily a huge hit at the time when it came out, but it influenced so many bands over the course of the intervening decades.
Oh, I mean, it really did. It was a real slow burner, barely if... I'm not even sure. It might have just crawled maybe into the top 50 in the US, but didn't make a huge impression at the time. But as people came to discover it, and like most notably Michael Stipe, like it was literally a life changing album for him. He has some great quote about something like, he listened to it and it pretty much tore my limbs off and put them back on in a different way. I decided there and then that I was going to be in a band. So, I mean, thank you, Patty, because without maybe, we wouldn't have the REM we all know and love. And again, like, I think it was Courtney Love as well from Hole. She just said, look, that just changed. I didn't know you could actually make sort of slightly transgressive music like that and not get arrested. So again, and it began to pick up awards. I mean, it was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 2021. I mean, it routinely makes lists. But I think her one of the big legacies, and I don't think it's really kind of talked about enough, is actually what she did for women, because she, from the very, even the cover itself, it's that uncompromising, unsmiling, you don't have to, you know, smile and look pretty for the camera. She just has that expression on, like she was just thinking about nothing in particular. She has that androgynous look. She didn't dress up for it. And her music did sort of say that you don't have to go out and be a crowd pleaser and a people pleaser. You know, you can be tough and you can be uncompromising. And I think that probably an awful lot of female artists that were, you know, playing records at home just took that on board and just went, yeah, I can do that.
We're going to finish by playing, it might be the song that people might know best from the album Redondo Beach. Maybe you'd introduce it for us.
Yeah, Redondo Beach is, again, it's one of those strange and mixes of everything. The lyric seems to be about a young man who had a fight with his girlfriend, and he and she went off and disappeared and just was discovered drowned in the sea. It tells a story from a male point of view, which again is what Patty used to do, but actually it was a story from her own life. She was in the Chelsea Hotel with her sister Linda. They had a fight and Linda disappeared off for a day, and Patty was distraught and imagined all kinds of things. And this sort of, she stuck the lyrics of this in the drawer for years and just kind of suddenly remembered it at some stage, overlaid again with that jaunty reggae beat. So just what I'm saying, you have no idea what's coming. You never do with Patty. God bless her, and long may she be on the stage.
Lisa Hand, thanks a million for joining us tonight. Let's hear Redondo Beach.